Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
And today we are diving into, well, quite a remarkable collection of source material.
It really is. It feels like one of those days where all the fault lines, legal, financial, geopolitical, just decided to converge in a single news cycle.
Yeah.
Quite a document of the volatility we're seeing.
That's exactly it. So our focus today is the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, November 6, 2025.
And our mission, as always, is to give you that comprehensive, truly exhaustive, and detailed report.
We're aiming to go beyond just the headlines, digging into every key article, every implication. We want to analyze the critical news from the day we're talking U.S. legal battles, boiling geopolitical tensions, some big market movers, and frankly, some pretty surprising social shifts.
Yeah, we want to look at the sort of structural conflicts underneath these stories. You know, things like the constitutional fight over who really controls tariffs or that almost political schizophrenia gripping New York City right now.
Absolutely. But before we get into all that policy and politics, let's quickly set the scene financially. It helps to ground ourselves in the market's mood. So what did the Journal tell us about the momentum going into Thursday?
Well, interestingly, despite all the turmoil we're about to unpack, the markets actually showed some resilience. They finished the day generally positive.
Okay.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average, it closed at 47,311. That was up 0.48%.
Hmm.
The NASDAQ, which is heavy on tech stocks, saw a bit more lift, up 0.6% to finish near 23,500. And the S&P 500 also gained 0.4%.
So the main indices are looking pretty solid. Confidence seems okay, especially in growth sectors.
It seems so, on the surface. But then you look at other indicators.
Like bonds. What about the safer assets? Sometimes they tell a different story.
Exactly. Fixed income saw a slight move. The 10-year treasury yield ticked up just a bit to 4.156%. So a little bit of selling off bonds, but not dramatic. But commodities, that's where you see a really crucial mixed signal. Oil actually dropped down almost a dollar, closing at $59.60 a barrel. Seems like global supply is holding up for now.
But there's always a but.
But gold, you know, the classic safe haven, it was soaring. It gained over $32 to close at $3,980.30 an ounce.
Wow, that's a significant jump.
It really is. And it suggests that even with the stock market looking okay, there's this deep underlying anxiety about geopolitical uncertainty bubbling just beneath the surface. That kind of fear often pushes capital towards gold.
That gold spike is definitely something to keep an eye on. Now, on the corporate side, you mentioned movers. There was one stock that stood out as a massive anomaly, right? A real head scratcher.
Oh, absolutely. Palantir. The data analytics company.
Huh.
It plummeted a shocking 8%.
8%? But didn't they beat expectations?
They did. Comfortably beat quarterly expectations. And yet, the stock tanks. Analysts immediately jumped on this, seeing it as a sign of maybe broader market sensitivity, especially around these highly speculative assets, you know, the ones tied to the big, expensive promise of AI.
So delivering good news isn't enough anymore?
Apparently not. If the valuation is already sky high, the fact that a company can hit its numbers and still lose almost a tenth of its value in a day tells you something. Volatility isn't just about reacting to bad news. It's almost baked into the structure of the market right now, especially in tech.
That volatility is actually a perfect bridge to our first major topic because it deals with perhaps the biggest legal uncertainty hanging over the global economy right now, the scope of presidential power, specifically around tariffs. Let's unpack what was happening at the Supreme Court.
Right. So the Supreme Court heard arguments focusing on one of President Trump's signature policy tools, his global tariffs.
The ones imposed pretty broadly.
Exactly. And the core legal challenge is this. Did the president go beyond the authority Congress gave him way back in the 1970s under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the IEPA?
Okay, IEEPA. And what was that originally for?
It was designed to let the president regulate financial dealings with foreign entities during a declared international emergency. The Trump administration's argument is that this power to regulate financial transactions includes the power to slap tariffs on goods unilaterally.
But the moment you say tariffs, that sounds awfully close to taxes. And isn't taxing Congress's job?
That's precisely where the justices seemed most skeptical. Justice Sotomayor, among others, really pushed on this. She questioned whether Congress would just casually surrender its most fundamental constitutional power, the power to raise revenue, the power as a purse to the president, through what they saw as a potentially vague 1970s law.
Because tariffs are taxes, fundamentally, paid by importers, often passed to consumers.
Correct. So for the executive branch to claim that power, based on IEPA, seemed, to Justice Sotomayor at least, to run directly counter to the Constitution's design, which says tax bills have to start in the House.
And Justice Coney Barrett pointed out the practical nightmare if the court actually rules against the administration, right? She called it a mess.
A total mess. Think about it. If the court says these tariffs imposed under IEEPA were unconstitutional all along, what happens next?
That's the billion-dollar question. Literally, maybe trillions, hundreds of millions, certainly billions in duties have been paid. Do they get that back? How? The administrative challenge of unwinding years of this policy, affecting potentially thousands of businesses and products, it's immense. That uncertainty alone is already having a chilling effect on business planning and investment.
Now, Justice Gorsuch raised a hypothetical that really seemed to crystallize just how broad the administration claims this power is. It went way beyond just trade disputes.
It really did. It was probably the most talked about moment from the oral arguments. He asked the Solicitor General, John Sauer, this. Could a future president, using these same emergency powers under IEEP, decide that climate change is an emergency?
Okay.
And then impose, say, a 50% tariff on all gas-powered cars and auto parts imported into the U.S.
And what did Sauer say?
He conceded, yes.
Yeah.
He argued the statute grants the power to regulate foreign financial transactions in an amount and form deemed appropriate by the president in an emergency.
Wow. So declare an emergency, pick a target, set a massive tariff. That's a staggering amount of power.
It implies the president could unilaterally reshape huge sectors of the U.S. economy, maybe for reasons that aren't even primarily economic, just by declaring an emergency.
It sounds like Chief Justice Roberts saw that danger and invoked a specific legal concept to push back. The major questions doctrine.
Exactly. This is a doctrine the court has been developing, essentially as a check on the power of federal agencies, which are part of the executive branch.
How does it work?
In simple terms, it says that if the executive branch wants to make a decision on a major federal policy, question something with vast economic and political significance, like remaking international trade or radically shifting energy policy, it can't rely on vague or ambiguous language in an old statute like IEPA.
They need clear, explicit permission from Congress for something that big.
That's the core idea. You can't infer massive power from ambiguous phrasing. Roberts specifically called the administration's interpretation of IEPA, this idea that it grants a power to impose tariffs on any product from any country in any amount for any length of time. He called it a misfit for the statute's original purpose.
And why is using this doctrine so significant here?
Because it represents a potential fundamental shift. Traditionally, under something called Chevron deference, courts often deferred to agencies' interpretations of laws Congress wrote. The major questions doctrine flips that for big issues. It tells the executive, if you're going to do something huge, show us exactly where Congress clearly said you could. If the court uses this doctrine to strike down the tariffs, it could significantly limit presidential power across many, many areas of regulation in the future.
Fascinating. But even if the court rules against the administration on the IEPA tariffs, this probably isn't the end of the trade fight, is it? Are there backup plans?
Oh, you can bet trade lawyers are already working on them. The administration has other tools. They've already used a different authority, Section 232, which is based on national security concerns, to impose tariffs on things like steel, aluminum, even potentially cars.
So they could just expand those?
Yeah, they could try. They could argue more imports threaten national security and bring them under the Section 232 umbrella. Or there's another option. A somewhat obscure provision in the 1974 Trade Act.
What does that allow?
It lets the president impose tariffs up to 15% for a limited time, 150 days, specifically to address trade imbalances. It hasn't been used much, but it's there.
So the legal justification might shift, but the tariffs could potentially continue in some form.
It's very possible. As one former official put it, if the ruling goes against them, government trade lawyers would be working through nights coming up with my fallback plans. The trade conflict might just change its legal clothes.
A really crucial legal battle with huge economic stakes. Okay, let's pivot from that aspect of national authority, the power to tax imports, to another critical area, national resources and security. Specifically, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the SPR.
Yeah, and this is almost a textbook case of a long-term national security risk being potentially sacrificed for short-term political goals.
What's the current state of the SPR?
It's low. Really low, some of the lowest levels in about 40 years. This continues the trend from the previous administration, which drew down reserves heavily to try and combat rising gas prices.
But President Trump had pledged to refill it aggressively, hadn't he?
He did make that pledge. But the actions, particularly in the latest budget legislation, seem to go in the opposite direction.
What's the fundamental conflict there? Why not just buy the oil back?
It boils down to a clash between national security preparedness and keeping gasoline prices low at the pump. To refill the SPR quickly, the government would need to buy massive amounts of crude oil off the global market,
which would increase demand and likely push prices up.
Exactly. Higher gas prices are politically toxic. And you see this conflict reflected directly in the budget numbers. The big tax and spending bill President Trump signed actually slashed funding for SPR crude purchases down to only $171 million.
From what? What was it before?
It was apparently around $1.3 billion in an earlier version of the bill. So a massive cut. And Congress hasn't seemed particularly urgent about allocating the funds either.
Okay, let's talk scale. If they did have the political will and the money, what would it actually take to refill the SPR?
It's a huge undertaking, both in cost and time. The SPR's total capacity is about 714 million barrels. Now, Congress has already mandated some future sales, so taking those into account, the administration needs to buy back roughly 375 million barrels just to fulfill the promise of refilling what was drawn down.
And the cost? At current prices?
Well, oil is around $60 a barrel right now, so 375 million barrels times $60, you're looking at about $22.5 billion just for the oil itself.
$22.5 billion. And how long would it take?
Even if they had the money tomorrow, experts estimate it would take more than 2 years, probably longer, to physically inject that much oil back into the underground salt caverns where it's stored. Mm-hmm. The logistics are complex.
And all this is happening, this sort of neglect of the reserve, at a time when the U.S. is involved in some pretty tense geopolitical situations involving major oil producers?
That's the real danger here. The Journal calls it combustible geopolitics.
Yeah.
Washington is currently, you know, actively bombing, threatening, or sanctioning Iran, Venezuela, and Russia.
And together, those three produce a significant chunk of the world's oil.
Over 15% of global production. So while markets seem relatively calm right now, with oil at $60, analysts are really warning about complacency. Kevin Book, an analyst quoted in the Journal, put it bluntly, "You're not guaranteed to get a $60 price forever."
So the U.S. is running down its emergency buffer just as it's potentially increasing the risk of a supply disruption.
That's the core risk. If there's a major geopolitical event, an escalation involving Iran, a collapse in Venezuela, something further with Russia that disrupts supply, oil prices could spike dramatically.
Yeah.
And if prices shoot up to, say, $100 to $120 a barrel, the cost of refilling the SPR becomes astronomical, maybe politically impossible. The U.S. would be caught without its cushion right when it needs it most.
It's that classic tension between managing today's political pain versus preparing for tomorrow's potential crisis.
Okay, before we move on to the election results, let's touch on one more domestic legal issue, this one involving conditions at an immigration detention facility. Seems the judiciary had to step in forcefully. Yes, this concerns a facility in Broadview, Illinois, near Chicago. A federal judge there, U.S. District Judge Robert Gettleman, issued a pretty sweeping order demanding the government drastically improve conditions.
What prompted such a strong intervention? What were the conditions like?
The reports described were frankly appalling. Lawyers were calling the facility, which was really only designed for very short-term holding, a black site.
A black site?
Yeah. Immigrants were allegedly being held for days, even weeks, in what the lawsuit called disgusting, squalid, and unsanitary conditions. Often without proper access to lawyers, sometimes without bedding, basic hygiene supplies.
And the judge found this unacceptable.
Completely. Judge Gettleman was very direct, stating that being forced to sleep on the floor next to an overflowed toilet, that's obviously unconstitutional.
So what did his order specifically require?
It mandated basic standards of human dignity, providing bedding, hygiene supplies, access to daily showers, ensuring clean toilets, and providing 3 meals a day. Things you might assume are standard, but apparently weren't happening consistently.
And how did the government respond to that order?
Well, their response really highlighted the core tension here. The Justice Department argued in court that making these kinds of significant changes, providing these basic necessities consistently, would, quote, effectively halt the government's ability to enforce immigration laws in Illinois.
Wow. So meeting basic constitutional standards would stop enforcement. That's quite an admission.
It reveals a deep systemic problem, doesn't it? If the enforcement mechanism relies on conditions that a judge deems unconstitutional, then fixing those conditions inherently disrupts the mechanism. It puts the mandate for robust enforcement in direct conflict with the constitutional rights and basic humanitarian standards that apply to everyone in government custody.
A really stark illustration of that conflict. Okay, let's transition now from court orders and oil reserves to the political arena, specifically the aftermath of Tuesday's elections and some really surprising results.
Yes. The results, particularly in Virginia and New Jersey, offered Democrats what the Journal called a potential path to revival. The wins there were much larger than many expected.
Give us the specifics. Who won and by how much?
In Virginia, you had Abigail Spanberger, a centrist Democrat with a national security background, winning the governorship by nearly 15 points. That was a huge margin.
And that had down ballot effects, too.
Big time. Her coattails apparently flipped 13 seats in the State House of Delegates, giving Democrats a solid majority there, which could be crucial for things like redistricting.
Okay, and New Jersey.
Similar story, different state. Mikey Sherrill, another centrist woman, also with a national security profile, won the governorship there by 13 percentage points. That's a massive increase compared to the previous Democratic governor, who only won by about 3 points back in 2021.
So what was the winning strategy? The Journal analysis pointed to a couple of key things.
It seems to be a combination. First, both candidates hammered away on an affordability agenda. They focused relentlessly on kitchen table economic issues, promising concrete actions to lower costs for families.
And the second part, tying their opponents to President Trump.
Very successfully, it seems. The Republican candidates really struggled to create their own independent identities. The numbers bear this out. In New Jersey, the GOP candidate, Jack Chiatarelli, got 43% of the vote. President Trump's approval rating in New Jersey, exactly 43%.
A direct match.
Almost uncanny. In Virginia, the Republican, Winsome Earl Sears, got 42%, slightly higher than Trump's 39% approval there, but still very closely linked. Exit polls suggested that voters were more motivated by opposition to Trump than by specific enthusiasm for the Republican candidates.
And the voter turnout patterns and demographic shifts, those looked particularly worrying for Republicans, didn't they?
Extremely worrying for the GOP looking ahead. Democratic turnout was much closer to presidential year levels than Republican turnout was. That's a bad sign for the GOP in off-year elections.
And specific groups moved significantly.
Yes. And crucially, it reversed some recent trends where the GOP had been making gains. Latino voters swung back hard toward the Democrats, up 9 points in New Jersey, 5 points in Virginia compared to previous cycles.
That's substantial.
It is. You saw it clearly in places like Passaic County, New Jersey, which is heavily Latino.
Yeah.
Trump actually won that county by 3 points last year. Sherrill, the Democrat, won it by 15 points this year, a huge swing.
And what about younger voters?
That might be the biggest alarm bell for the Republicans, voters under 30. The GOP candidates lost this group by nearly 40 points in both states.
40 points. How does that compare to 2024?
In 2024, President Trump lost young voters in those states, but only by about 5 points. So to go from losing by 5 points to losing by 40 points in just a year, that suggests a massive, maybe fundamental disconnect between the current GOP platform and younger voters.
So what's the takeaway from Republican strategists? Are they hitting the panic button?
Some sound pretty alarmed. Michael Duhaime, who used to be the RNC's political director, was quoted saying, "There is no sugarcoating these results. They're really bad for the party." The consensus seems to be that, especially in competitive states or districts, GOP candidates can't just rely on the Trump base anymore. They need to build their own brand, probably more towards the center, focus on those economic affordability issues, and find ways to distance themselves from the kind of polarization that seems to be driving away young voters and suburban moderates.
That's a significant warning for the party. But speaking of really unexpected political outcomes, the biggest shockwave probably came out of New York City.
Oh, absolutely. The election of Zohran Mamdani as mayor. The Journal calls it the impossible victory.
A 34-year-old Democratic socialist winning the mayoralty of New York City. How did that happen?
It's a truly stunning result. He won with over 1 million votes, defeating both former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who ran as an independent, and the Republican Curtis Sliwa. And the turnout was incredible. The highest in a New York City mayoral race since 1969. He clearly mobilized a huge segment of the electorate that hadn't been participating before.
So how did he pull it off? New York is usually governed by more centrist, pragmatic Democrats. What was his strategy?
He relentlessly, almost singularly, focused on affordability and housing.
While a lot of the media coverage was about crime and public safety, Mamdani seemed to understand that for a huge number of New Yorkers, the number one stress is just the crushing cost of living.
So specific policies.
Very specific, very tangible promises. Things like free bus service citywide, free childcare for kids up to age 5, and the big one, a rent freeze on the city's 1 million rent-stabilized apartments.
And that message clearly resonated with specific voter groups.
Massively. He built his winning coalition squarely on economic lines. He won renters by a huge margin, over 24 points. He managed to flip low-income voters, those earning under $50,000 a year. He'd lost that group in the primary, but won them by almost 9 points in the general election.
And across racial lines as well?
Yes. His economic message seemed to cut across. He won overwhelmingly in majority black neighborhoods by nearly 30 points and in majority Hispanic neighborhoods by over 20 points.
Now, New York politics often involves navigating sensitive issues around the Middle East. How did Mamdani handle that, given his outspoken views?
That was a real wild card. Mamdani has been very vocal in his pro-Palestinian stance, even making accusations of genocide against Israel. Many thought that would be disqualifying in a city with the largest Jewish population outside Israel.
But it wasn't.
Apparently not. In fact, it seems his stance might have actually energized younger voters, who turned out in very high numbers for him, both in the primary and the general. Plus, you can't discount the political context.
The three-way race.
Exactly. You had the centrist vote splitting between Cuomo and Sliwa. That allowed Mamdani to consolidate the progressive and working class vote and win with just over 50%, 50.4% to be exact. The incumbent mayor, Eric Adams, was wounded politically, which also created an opening.
And the reaction from the city's financial and business elite, the Journal described an atmosphere of defeat and dread.
Palpable dread, especially after they spent millions trying to stop him. Hedge fund managers like Bill Ackman poured over $2 million into opposing Mamdani. Cliff Asness apparently compared the result to the planet being destroyed.
So what are they specifically afraid of?
Taxes, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Mamdani campaigned on things like an additional 2% tax on millionaires, higher business taxes. Mm-hmm. The fear on Wall Street is that these policies will kill the business climate, drive wealthy residents and companies out of the city. And of course, public safety remains a huge concern for them.
The future of the current NYPD commissioner, Jessica Tisch, seems to be a key focus.
Absolutely. She's seen by the business community as very effective, someone who really prioritized reducing crime. Mamdani has said he'll ask her to stay on.
But will she?
That's the million-dollar question. If she decides to leave, it will send a massive signal, likely interpreted by Wall Street and others as a sign that the new administration isn't serious about maintaining order. President Trump has already basically threatened to withhold federal funds or use ICE more aggressively if he doesn't like the direction the city takes under Mamdani, so the pressure is intense.
It's fascinating, though, because while Mamdani won on this platform that's quite critical of development, voters approved other measures on the same ballot that actually make it easier to build housing.
This is the paradox, the sort of political schizophrenia of NYC right now. While voters elected Mamdani, who wants rent freezes, they also approved three ballot referendums that were strongly backed by real estate developers.
And what do these referendums do?
They're designed to streamline the notoriously difficult process of getting housing projects approved in New York. The most significant one effectively eliminates something called member deference.
What's that?
It was basically an informal tradition where the local city council member for a district had veto power over any new development project in their area. Killing that tradition removes a major roadblock for developers.
So the city elects a socialist mayor who is skeptical of developers, but simultaneously votes to make developers' lives easier.
Exactly. It's a bizarre outcome. Developers are apparently thrilled with the referendum results, seeing it as creating speed and predictability. They think it sets up guardrails that will keep affordable housing projects moving forward, almost regardless of the mayor's rhetoric.
Which creates a huge internal tension for the Mamdani administration right from day one.
A massive tension. Does he embrace this new streamlined process that voters just approved, potentially leading to more housing construction, which could ease the affordability crisis? Or does he try to use his executive powers to block or slow down the very development the referendum was designed to facilitate? How he navigates that contradiction could define his mayoralty.
A really fascinating dynamic to watch. Okay, let's swing back to President Trump. His reaction to those GOP losses in Virginia and New Jersey wasn't just about blaming others. He proposed a pretty radical change to how Washington works.
Yeah, his diagnosis was fairly typical. Trump, he blamed the recent government shutdown. He blamed the fact that he personally wasn't on the ballot. but his proposed solution was much more fundamental.
He targeted a long-standing Senate procedure.
The filibuster. Even though Republicans hold a relatively narrow 53-47 majority in the Senate, he urged them to jettison the filibuster, get rid of the 60-vote requirement that's needed to pass most major legislation.
Why? What was his reasoning?
Purely maximizing power. He argued that with a simple majority, the GOP could pass legislation at levels you've never seen before. He specifically mentioned things like new restrictions on mail-in voting and mandatory voter ID laws. His pitch was essentially, get rid of the filibuster and Republicans can lock in their policy goals and potentially ensure long-term dominance.
But that idea ran into immediate opposition from senior Republicans in the Senate, didn't it?
It did. Key figures like the Senate Majority Leader John Thune and Senator Susan Collins immediately pushed back. They defended the filibuster.
On what grounds?
They see it as an important institutional safeguard, not just an obstruction, but something that forces bipartisanship, or at least prevents the most extreme legislation, from passing on purely party-line votes whenever one party has a temporary slim majority. Collins specifically said she believes it helps to produce bipartisan initiatives.
So a real philosophical divide within the GOP itself about the rules of the game.
Exactly. Should you use whatever power you have at the moment to change the rules and push your agenda through? Or do you preserve the institutional norms that sometimes frustrate your party, but also protect the minority and encourage broader consensus? That debate is clearly not settled within the Republican Party.
These struggles over power, whether it's in Congress or City Hall, they kind of mirror the high-stakes, high-volatility world we see in another major area, artificial intelligence. Let's transition now and look at some corporate giants, their AI ambitions, and some really puzzling valuations.
And we have to start with Elon Musk. His focus seems to have shifted dramatically towards his AI startup, xAI, and its chatbot, Grok. And this is causing some jitters among Tesla investors.
Understandably, Tesla just reported its second straight quarterly drop in vehicle sales, down about 13.5%. You'd think he'd be laser-focused on the core car business right now.
But the reporting suggests the opposite. He's been practically living at xAI, holed up in the Palo Alto offices, sometimes sleeping there, trying desperately to catch up to competitors like OpenAI in the AI race.
He was even holding Tesla meetings at the xAI office.
Apparently so. That level of intense focus on the new venture, right when Tesla's main business is facing headwinds, is definitely raising eyebrows.
And this is all happening while Tesla shareholders are voting on that absolutely mind-boggling compensation package for him.
Mind-boggling is the right word. The potential payout is up to $1 trillion in stock over 10 years. It would increase his stake in Tesla from around 15% now to potentially 25%.
$1 trillion. What does he have to do to get that?
The targets are astronomically ambitious, hitting a market capitalization for Tesla of $8.5 trillion.
$8.5 trillion.
Yes. And, maybe even more revealing of his focus, one of the key targets is selling 1 million units of the Optimus humanoid robot.
So the future value is seen in AI and robotics, not just cars.
That seems to be the explicit bet embedded in the compensation plan. It signals that Tesla sees itself fundamentally as an AI and robotics company long term.
How is the Tesla board justifying his divided attention, especially with this huge potential payout on the line?
The board chair, Robin Denholm, basically defended it as just who Musk is. She used an analogy. Other CEOs might like to play golf. He doesn't play golf.
Huh.
So he likes to create companies. The argument is that his work at xAI will ultimately benefit Tesla anyway, because Tesla needs cutting-edge AI for self-driving cars and for the Optimus robot.
Musk himself linked the package to control, right?
Yeah, he essentially said he needs the package approved to ensure he maintains enough voting control over Tesla, claiming he's not going to build a robot army if I could be kicked out. It's about ensuring his long-term vision, which is heavily AI-centric, remains dominant.
But the development at xAI hadn't been without controversy. There was a really disturbing issue reported concerning employee biometric data. Project Skippy.
Yes, Project Skippy. This involved the creation of a specialized chatbot named Annie. The description was memorable. A racy, animated female character, kind of like a love interest from Japanese anime.
Okay, and the controversy.
It centered on the employees hired to train xAI's models, the tutors. They were apparently required, as a condition of employment, to sign away extensive rights to their own biometric data. We're talking faces, voices.
Sign away how? What did the agreement say?
It required them to grant xAI a perpetual, worldwide, non-exclusive, sublicensable, royalty-free license to use their faces and voices.
Forever. Royalty-free. To train avatars like this Ani character.
Exactly. And employees were deeply concerned.
The report mentioned one employee specifically asking if the company could sell her face to be used in deepfake videos by others. The company later clarified that providing this data, including doing audio and video recording sessions, was a mandatory job requirement.
Using employees' actual faces and voices to train a sexually suggestive chatbot seems ethically questionable, to say the least.
Highly questionable. It caused significant backlash, both inside and outside the company, raising serious concerns about data privacy, exploitation, and the potential misuse of deepfake technology being developed using employees' own identities.
It definitely paints a picture of relentless, perhaps boundary-pushing ambition at xAI. Now let's contrast that with its main competitor, OpenAI. Their financial strategy seems quite different right now.
Very different. OpenAI CFO Sarah Friar made it clear an initial public offering, an IPO, is not on the cards right now. Their priority is growth, research, and development, not immediate profitability.
But the really surprising part was their request for government help, wasn't it?
That was the stunner. They're apparently hoping the federal government might step in to either backstop or guarantee the financing for their future massive data center expansions.
Why would OpenAI, arguably the hottest private tech company in the world, need government guarantees? Can't they raise private capital?
According to Friar, the sheer cost of building the infrastructure needed for advanced AI is becoming almost unmanageable, even for them. She called the capital expenditure unheard of.
Because the AI chips are so expensive and become obsolete quickly?
That seems to be the core issue. The depreciation rate on these incredibly expensive specialized AI chips is uncertain, making traditional financing for these massive multi-billion-dollar data center deals very difficult and costly. So they're proposing an ecosystem involving banks, private equity, and maybe even governmental support to lower the cost of financing and allow them to build at the necessary scale.
Okay, let's pause here because this is a really important contrast. You have Musk potentially getting $1 trillion, driving xAI with pure ambition, and you have OpenAI, the market leader, basically admitting they need potential government backing to afford the infrastructure arms race.
It really highlights the immense, maybe even fragile, financial underpinnings of this whole AI boom. The capital requirements are so vast that even the most successful player is looking for ways to de-risk their spending, potentially shifting some of that risk onto the taxpayer.
Which brings us perfectly back to Palantir. We mentioned their stock drop, but the real story is that underlying valuation, which seems completely detached from reality.
Utterly detached. Let's just restate the numbers because they're staggering. Palantir has a market value of around $490 billion.
Right.
That makes it the 18th most valuable stock in America.
Bigger than some household name companies?
Bigger than major oil companies, major financial institutions. Yet its sales over the past year, less than $4 billion.
Less than $4 billion in sales, but nearly $500 billion in market value. Let's translate that into a ratio people might understand, the price to sales ratio.
Okay, so a typical healthy, fast growing tech company might trade at, say, 8 or 10 times its forecasted revenue for the next year. Maybe a bit higher if there's a lot of hype.
And Palantir?
Palantir is trading at 30 times forecast revenue. 30.
That's extraordinary.
It's statistically unprecedented for a company of that size in the S&P 500. It dwarfs the PS ratios of giants like Microsoft, Alphabet, Oracle. It suggests the market isn't valuing Palantir based on its current business at all. It's purely a bet on some future, almost inevitable dominance in AI that hasn't materialized in sales yet.
And the CEO, Alex Karp, his response is basically, "You just don't understand us."
Pretty much. He's quoted as saying analysts don't know what the company is truly worth. He's leaning entirely into the mystique and the future potential, dismissing conventional financial metrics. It's a bold strategy, banking everything on future promise.
From the speculative world of AI valuations, let's shift to another high-stakes, high-growth area, pharmaceuticals, specifically the bidding war over weight loss drugs.
This market is absolutely exploding. We're talking potentially $72 billion in global sales this year, projected to hit nearly $140 billion by 2030. It's a gold rush.
And the current battle is over a startup called Metsera.
Exactly. A relatively young startup, only 3 years old, but with promising potential in the weight loss drug space. And it sparked a bidding war between two giants, Pfizer and Novo Nordisk.
Novo Nordisk, who already dominate the market with Ozempic and Wegovy.
Right. So initially, Pfizer had a deal to buy Metsera for around $7.3 billion. Then Novo Nordisk jumped in with an unsolicited offer.
Trying to buy out the competition.
It's like it. Novo Nordisk kept raising its bid, eventually reaching about $10 billion. Pfizer countered, raising its offer to $8.1 billion, But Metsera's board decided Novo's $10 billion offer was superior.
Which forced Pfizer's hand.
It did. Pfizer is now scrambling. They either have to significantly sweeten their $8.1 billion bid or risk losing Metsera entirely to their biggest competitor.
And this intense corporate battle has attracted regulatory attention.
Immediately. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, is watching very closely. Pfizer actually sued Metsera to try and block them from walking away from the original deal, raising antitrust concerns, arguing that letting Novo Nordisk buy Metsera would further consolidate an already dominated market.
And the FTC itself warned Novo Nordisk.
Yes, the FTC sent a warning letter about the structure of Novo's proposed deal. Novo wanted to buy non-voting shares first, and then acquire the rest later, after getting regulatory approval. The FTC basically said, hang on, this looks like it's designed to deliberately sidestep or delay the antitrust review process.
So the regulators are signaling they won't let these giants just snap up all the promising startups without a fight.
It seems so. The FTC is clearly concerned about maintaining competition in this incredibly lucrative market, and seems willing to intervene early if they suspect companies are trying to game the system. It shows how intertwined corporate strategy, market growth, and regulatory power are in these key sectors.
Absolutely. Okay, that theme of global competition, resource security, and high stakes leads us directly into perhaps the most volatile area we need to cover, geopolitics.
And we have to start with a deeply concerning development, the renewed nuclear tensions between the United States and Russia. This wasn't just rhetoric. It involved immediate, concrete actions.
What was the exchange? What was said and done?
President Trump made comments suggesting the U.S. might need to resume nuclear weapons testing, something neither country has done for decades.
And Putin's response?
Immediate and escalatory. Russian President Vladimir Putin publicly ordered his top security officials, military and civilian, to draw up plans for Russia to conduct its own nuclear tests if the U.S. actually goes first. He used very specific language, study the issue, and submit proposals for the possible commencement of work on preparations for nuclear weapons tests.
So not just a threat, but actual orders to prepare.
Exactly. It moves it from political posturing to operational planning.
Now, why is the idea of resuming testing, even potentially small tests, seen as so dangerous? Why does it raise the risk back to Cold War levels?
Because it shatters a longstanding norm and potentially unravels the already fragile arms control framework. Jeffrey Lewis, a respected security expert quoted in the journal, warned that if either side tests, it dramatically increases nuclear tensions and could easily trigger a new arms race.
Even though there's a treaty against testing.
There is the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the CTBT, which bans all nuclear explosions. Both the U.S. and Russia signed it. However, the U.S. Senate has never actually ratified the treaty, and Russia, in 2023, formally withdrew its ratification.
So the treaty is kind of hanging by a thread.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And if one side conducts a test, even if they try to frame it as a low-yield scientific experiment, the other side, and potentially other nuclear powers like China, might feel compelled to respond in kind. It could restart testing globally and fundamentally destabilize the delicate balance of nuclear deterrence.
A truly sobering prospect. Okay, let's pivot from that global strategic tension to the Middle East, specifically Gaza, where the ceasefire seems to be hitting a major unexpected snag.
Yes, a very physical, very dangerous problem. There are apparently hundreds of armed Hamas fighters. The estimates range from 100 to maybe 300 who are trapped.
Trapped where?
They're stuck in tunnels, but behind the line where Israeli forces withdrew to. So they're essentially in Israeli-controlled territory within Gaza, but underground.
And they still pose a threat.
A significant threat. The article mentions a recent incident where militants emerged from a tunnel shaft in this supposedly cleared area and killed two Israeli soldiers. It shows they are still armed, still capable of attacks, and represent a major complication for the ceasefire's stability.
So what's the sticking point in the negotiations regarding these trapped fighters?
It's a direct clash of demands.
Mm-hmm.
Hamas wants Israel to grant these fighters safe passage so they can return to Hamas-controlled areas of Gaza.
And Israel's position?
Israel insists they must either be killed or surrender. However, there's a grim calculation involved. Israel is reportedly trying to capture them rather than kill them outright in most encounters right now.
Why capture instead of eliminate the threat immediately?
Because of the remaining hostages. Israel fears that a large-scale operation to kill all these trapped militants could derail the ongoing, incredibly sensitive process of getting back the bodies of the remaining deceased hostages held by Hamas. The political pressure in Israel to secure the return of those bodies is immense, so it's currently overriding the immediate military goal of neutralizing these fighters.
We did see some progress on the hostage front reported.
Yes. The body of Itay Chen, who was an Israeli-American soldier killed back on October 7th, was returned as part of the ceasefire deal brokered by the U.S. That means there are still 7 deceased hostages, believed to be in Gaza, 1 Israeli soldier, and 2 foreigners among them.
So resolving the issue of the trapped fighters is critical before moving to the next phase.
Absolutely. The next phase is supposed to involve bigger, even harder steps, like the disarmament of Hamas forces and deploying some kind of international stabilization force. But none of that can really happen while you still have hundreds of armed militants operating behind Israeli lines. It's a major roadblock.
Okay, shifting focus slightly within the region to Syria. There's a report about a potentially major shift in U.S. policy there, involving sanctions and a meeting with the new leader.
This is quite a significant development. Syria's new leader, Ahmed al-Shara, is apparently scheduled to meet with President Trump.
And al-Shara has a complex background, right? Formerly linked to an al-Qaeda affiliate.
Yes, though he publicly disavowed that affiliation almost a decade ago. But the key policy move here is that the Trump administration is actively pushing to repeal the major U.S. sanctions on Syria, the ones imposed by the CSAR Act back in 2019.
Why repeal sanctions that were put in place specifically to punish the Assad regime for atrocities during the civil war? What's the administration's goal?
The stated goal is stabilization through economic recovery. The argument is that Syria desperately needs massive financial investment to rebuild after 13 years of devastating civil war. Without that investment, the administration fears the country will inevitably slide back into chaos and conflict. They're calling it the no plan B argument, either allow investment by lifting sanctions or risk renewed war.
Is there any other justification being offered?
There's a mention that some American families, whose relatives disappeared in Syria during the war, actually support repealing the sanctions. They hope it might facilitate investigations and potentially lead to the discovery of mass graves.
But this must be incredibly controversial. What are the risks? What are critics saying?
The risks are huge. And critics are very vocal. They're deeply concerned about easing pressure on a government structure that, even under new leadership, still contains elements responsible for past repression. There are also reports that some of al-Shara's former rebel forces were involved in sectarian violence fairly recently.
So easing sanctions could be seen as letting them off the hook.
That's the fear. Prominent members of Congress worry that repealing the CSAR Act removes crucial leverage needed to ensure accountability and could effectively normalize relations too quickly. While some sanctions were temporarily suspended by executive order earlier this year, that suspension isn't enough to attract the kind of large-scale, long-term investment Syria really needs for reconstruction. So the administration feels forced to push for full repeal, balancing the risk of impunity against the risk of state collapse.
A really difficult geopolitical calculation. Let's move from the Middle East to South America and another story about resource security, this time involving Brazil and fertilizer deep in the Amazon.
Right. Brazil is a global agricultural giant, a powerhouse exporter, but it has this huge Achilles heel. It imports about 90% of its fertilizer needs.
And a lot of that comes from Russia.
Primarily from Russia. So when the war in Ukraine happened and Western sanctions hit Russia, It created a massive shock to Brazil's fertilizer supply chain. That threatened not just Brazil's food production, but potentially global food security, especially since Brazil handles a growing amount of agricultural trade, including U.S. exports going to China.
So Brazil needs a domestic source of fertilizer, and the answer lies in the Amazon.
A specific part of it, yes. There's a huge deposit of potash, a key fertilizer ingredient in the Amazon potash basin. It was actually discovered by accident decades ago. Now, a Canadian company, Toronto-based Brazil Potash Corp, is investing $2.5 billion to build a massive underground mine near a town called Atazes.
How significant could this one mine be?
Potentially transformative for Brazil's reliance on imports. This single mine is projected to supply about 1/5 of Brazil's total potash needs for the next 30 years, starting around 2030. It could make Brazil largely self-sufficient in this critical resource.
Sounds like a fantastic solution economically. But building a massive mine in the Amazon that immediately raises huge environmental red flags.
It absolutely does. This project cuts right to the heart of the whole debate about development versus conservation in the Amazon. While the mine itself will be underground, which minimizes the direct surface footprint.
It's the infrastructure needed to support it.
Exactly. Environmental groups are warning that the roads, the river ports, the power lines needed to build and operate this mine will inevitably open up previously inaccessible areas of the rainforest.
And that attracts illegal activity.
Historically, yes. Once you build roads into the jungle, it becomes much easier for illegal loggers, ranchers doing slash and burn, and illegal gold miners, garimperos, to move in. Authorities find it almost impossible to police these vast remote areas effectively. So the fear is that one legal, regulated mine acts as a gateway for widespread, uncontrolled destruction.
Yet, the article notes the company has actually managed to get support from many of the local indigenous communities. That seems unusual.
It is a complex dynamic. Indigenous groups in the Amazon have often fiercely resisted large development projects. But in this case, Brazil Potash Corp seems to have successfully persuaded most of the local Mura Indigenous Council villages, about 35 out of 40, to support the project.
Why? What swayed them?
Jobs, primarily. The promise of thousands of jobs during the construction phase and potentially hundreds of long-term operational jobs, plus maybe 30,000 indirect jobs in the region. For communities that are often heavily reliant on government aid, this offers a path to economic self-sufficiency. The local mayor is also championing it, arguing it's vital for both national food security and the local economy, and claiming that mining actually has a smaller environmental footprint than the rampant cattle ranching currently clearing forests.
So it's a stark trade-off, achieving national resource independence and providing local economic opportunity versus the potentially irreversible risks to a globally critical ecosystem. That high level of global flux and resource competition brings us neatly to our final segment, looking at some immediate tangible disruptions and safety issues back home.
And we can start with something that seems small, but affects daily life. The humble penny. Or rather, the lack thereof.
Right, the end of the penny at Burger King. This is a direct consequence of President Trump's decision to halt the production of new pennies, leading to a nationwide shortage.
Exactly. And it's causing real headaches for businesses that still handle a lot of cash, like fast food restaurants, grocery stores, convenience stores. They're struggling to make exact change.
How are they coping?
They're basically scrambling to hoard pennies. The article mentions one Burger King franchisee in Baltimore, Gary Andrzejewski. His staff are constantly hitting the banks for rolls of pennies, and he stockpiled 30 boxes, hoping it's enough to last just 2 months.
30 boxes of pennies. That highlights the sheer inefficiency of handling them too, right?
Absolutely. The article points out that $1,000 worth of pennies weighs about 500 pounds. Just storing and moving them is a logistical burden. And now cashiers are forced into doing mental math, rounding transactions up or down to the nearest nickel.
Which can't be popular with customers.
Definitely not. Especially lower income customers who are more likely to use cash. They feel like they're stuck with a math quiz just trying to buy a coffee, and they worry about being consistently shortchanged, even if it's just a few cents here and there. One customer mentioned her $2.23 coffee getting rounded up to $2.25. It feels unfair.
Is the shortage widespread?
It seemed to be getting worse. Trade groups reported that about half of the country's operating coin terminals, the places that distribute coins, have stopped circulating pennies in just the last couple of months. So it's becoming a pervasive problem, a real disruption in the basic mechanics of commerce.
From coin shortages to much bigger transportation headaches, the government shutdown is causing chaos in the airline industry.
Yes, the ongoing shutdown, now 36 days long, is hitting the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, hard. It's worsening the already existing staffing shortages among air traffic controllers.
And they're working without pay.
Working without pay? Under high stress, it's leading to fatigue, increased sick calls, and ultimately thousands of flight delays and cancellations across the entire U.S. air travel system.
And the FAA is taking drastic steps because of the safety risks.
They are. They've ordered a 10% reduction in air traffic volume at 40 major airports, starting this Friday. That's a huge cut.
10%? How many flights is that?
Aviation analysts estimate it could mean grounding as many as 1,800 flights per day.
Wow. Right before the holidays.
Exactly. Airlines are deeply worried about total chaos during the peak holiday travel season. They've apparently met with the vice president, basically pleading with the administration and Congress to pass a spending bill immediately and resolve the FAA staffing crisis before the system completely melts down.
Speaking of aviation safety concerns, there was also that tragic news about the UPS cargo plane crash in Kentucky.
A truly horrific incident in Louisville. At least 12 people were killed when a UPS cargo plane crashed.
What do we know about the plane and the cause?
The plane itself was quite old, a 34-year-old MD-11 model. Initial reports suggest an engine actually detached from the left wing during takeoff.
An engine detached, and there were prior maintenance issues?
That's a critical detail. Maintenance records show that this specific plane had been grounded for a significant period just recently, from early September to mid-October, for a major repair involving a cracked fuel tank.
Does this point to a broader issue with the age of cargo fleets?
It certainly raises questions. Cargo carriers like UPS and FedEx heavily rely on older aircraft, often planes that were converted from passenger service. The average age of a UPS-owned jet is around 22 years, but their MD-11s, like the one that crashed, average 31 years old.
And the MD-11 has a poor safety record.
Statistically, yes. The article notes it has the second worst safety record of any commercial aircraft type still in regular service today. While planes are designed to fly safely for decades with rigorous maintenance, the sheer age of many cargo fleets, combined with the intense operational demands of cargo flying, is an ongoing concern within the industry regarding long-term safety and maintenance adequacy.
Okay, let's shift gears dramatically now, from aviation hardware to Hollywood high stakes. The creator of the Yellowstone Empire, Taylor Sheridan, is making a big move.
A huge move. Taylor Sheridan is breaking ties with Paramount, the studio that launched his incredibly successful Yellowstone universe.
Why the split? Friction with new management?
Apparently so. He reportedly chafed under the new leadership at Paramount, specifically CEO David Ellison. So Sheridan has forged a massive new 5-year deal with NBC Universal instead.
Potentially worth how much?
The potential value is up to $1 billion. Though it's important to note his existing Paramount deal runs until 2029, so the NBC Universal partnership won't kick in until then.
What was it about Sheridan's shows Yellowstone, 1883, Mayor of Kingstown, Lioness, that tapped into the cultural zeitgeist so powerfully? Why did they become such a dominant force?
It's a fascinating mix. He seemed to perfectly capture a certain populist mood, maybe a feeling of being overlooked by coastal elites or traditional Hollywood. His shows were initially labeled Red State TV, but their appeal quickly broadened across all demographics.
What about the style?
His signature is this blend of, you might say, highbrow aesthetics and lowbrow content. You get these gorgeous cinematic landscapes and visuals, but paired with often graphic violence and pretty gritty storylines.
And the characters.
He creates these strong archetypes that really resonate. You have the stoic, hyper-masculine figures like Rip Wheeler in Yellowstone, reflecting what the journal called the ruder realities of the world and appealing to the manosphere. But he balances that with incredibly tough, capable, often ruthless female characters like Beth Dutton in Yellowstone or Zoe Saldana's character in Lioness.
His intense work pace also seemed to contribute to some off-screen drama, particularly with his biggest star.
Absolutely. The relentless production schedule Sheridan maintains was cited as a major source of friction in his feud with Kevin Costner, whose star power was essential to Yellowstone's initial success.
And that ended badly.
Very badly. Costner ended up leaving the show during its 5th season. Sheridan's response. He reportedly decided to kill off Costner's iconic character, John Dutton, in a particularly brutal way, staged as a suicide. That kind of real-life drama almost becomes part of the brand itself.
Okay, finally, let's bring this all back home and connect some of the threads. We talked about advanced AI earlier. Now let's look at the immediate personal security implications, specifically the threat of deepfakes.
This is a really concerning, growing trend. Criminals are using generative AI, the same kind of tech behind chatbots and image generators, to create incredibly realistic voice clones.
To do what?
To scam people, primarily targeting the elderly. They'll call pretending to be a grandchild or other loved one in distress, needing money wired immediately. And the AI-generated voices are now so convincing they can often bypass the initial, "Is this really you?" check.
So what's the defense against this kind of high-tech scam?
Ironically, the best defense being recommended is decidedly low-tech. Establish a family code word.
A secret word only the real family members would know.
Exactly. Or even better, a code question. Something simple but strong.
What makes a code word or question strong in this context?
It needs to be something that isn't easily guessable or discoverable online. So, not your pet's name, not your mother's maiden name, not the street you grew up on, nothing a scammer could find through social media or public records.
So more like a shared memory or an inside joke.
Precisely. An anecdote, a funny incident, a unique shared experience. And using a question like, "What was the name of that weird motel we stayed at on the beach trip when I was 10? can be even better, as it requires a specific, non-obvious answer, not just a single word that could potentially be overheard or compromised. And crucially, this code needs to be shared only within a very tight, trusted family circle.
This need for better personal digital security seems to connect to a broader issue raised in the journal, financial literacy and vulnerability, especially when financial knowledge isn't shared within a couple.
That's a really critical point, and the article highlighted it through the experience of a retired professor, Alice Stone Nepomofsky, who is 75.
What happened to her?
Her husband, Sasha, died unexpectedly, and she was suddenly left to manage their entire financial life, which turned out to be incredibly complex. She was faced with this convoluted spreadsheet listing dozens of different accounts, bank accounts, mutual funds, ETFs, individual stocks filled with jargon she didn't understand.
And she felt completely unprepared.
Utterly overwhelmed. Her grief was compounded by this sudden immense stress of potentially making a catastrophic financial mistake. Making it worse, she knew her husband had actually fallen victim to a Ponzi scheme years earlier, losing $350,000, so she was acutely aware of the risks.
She described feeling like a sitting duck.
Yes, vulnerable to errors, vulnerable to scams. And her situation is unfortunately common. Statistically, women tend to live longer than men, meaning they often inherit the full weight of financial management later in life, sometimes without having been involved in the day-to-day decisions earlier. This concentration of knowledge in just one partner creates a huge risk.
Did she manage to get help?
She did. She eventually worked with a financial advisor to consolidate and simplify their accounts. But her big takeaway, her deep regret, was not engaging with their finances much earlier while her husband was still alive.
And her advice now?
Her advice, which applies to all of us, really, was stark. Catastrophe can strike at any time. She now makes sure her adult children are present during her financial planning meetings, deliberately spreading that critical knowledge across the generations.
That personal story really brings home the relevance of all the big macro topics we've covered today, doesn't it? It connects the complexity of global finance, AI, geopolitics, right down to the most fundamental need to protect your own family and financial security.
It really does. We've gone from the Supreme Court debating the Constitution, to Elon Musk's trillion-dollar ambitions, to a socialist mayor in New York, to Russian nuclear threats, all the way down to penny shortages and family code words. It's the full spectrum of modern volatility and risk.
So if we try to synthesize the main themes from this deep dive into the journal for November 6th, 2025, what emerges? It feels like a world grappling with the consequences of unchecked power and unexpected risks colliding.
Definitely. You see massive volatility driven by things like potential presidential overreach on tariffs, the almost boundless ambition and questionable ethics in the AI race, and these sudden sharp political shifts like Mondani's win or the Democratic resurgence in the governor's race.
And alongside that ambition and volatility, there's this constant underlying theme of contingency planning, isn't there? Both big and small.
Everywhere you look. The administration needs backup legal plans if the Supreme Court strikes down IEPA tariffs using the major questions doctrine. The FAA needs an emergency plan to cut slights because the government can't keep basic functions funded. Individual businesses are hoarding pennies because the currency system itself is suddenly unreliable at the micro level.
Which leads us to that final provocative thought. We spent time looking at the pursuit of physical resource security. Brazil needing its own potash for fertilizer independence, the U.S. neglecting its strategic oil reserves, even while engaging in combustible geopolitics.
And we connected that physical security need to the need for digital security of our own identities, requiring personal code words to fend off AI voice scams.
So what does it say about our current moment when these foundational elements, the reliability of currency, the security of communication, the stability of energy reserves, even the predictability of political outcomes, all seem increasingly fragile and contingent?
It suggests an era defined by uncertainty, where the systems we used to take for granted suddenly feel unreliable. It forces a constant state of vigilance and adaptation.
So we'll leave you, our listener, with this question to think about. Reflecting on the sheer range of volatility and the need for backup plans we've explored today, from global strategy down to personal finance, what area of your own life, maybe one you haven't focused on, might need a better contingency plan right now?
It's certainly worth considering. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into today's Wall Street Journal. We hope this detailed exploration leaves you feeling thoroughly informed.